Hola, this is Gustavo Arellano, columnist at the Los Angeles Times and host of the podcast, The Times, daily news from the LA Times. I'll be your guest host for the next few weeks. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the second week of July, and this week, the Bureau of Labor Statistics released a very depressing inflation report. The consumer price index spiked by 9.1% over the past year ending in June, a figure worse than many economists predicted. Inflation rose to its highest level in more than 40 years. The numbers are driven largely by gas prices that soared in June, reaching record-breaking levels. But those prices are starting to fall a bit recently, 40 cents in 2 weeks in my neighborhood spot, so now I'm just paying $5.59 a gallon for 87 octane. Yay me. President Joe Biden said that the surge was, quote, unacceptably high, and pointed to the fact that the numbers, quote, are also out of date. He remains steadfast that inflation is his top priority. But this is all bad news for American consumers and the Federal Reserve, which means that the threat of a recession is on everyone's mind. To talk about it, let's bring in our left, right, and center panel. I'm your guest host and your columnist center. Make what you will of that. On the right, I'm joined by Sarah Isger, staff writer at The Dispatch. She was a spokesperson at the Department of Justice under President Trump. Hey, Sarah.
Hi.
And on the left, we're joined by Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic. Hi, Liz.
Hey.
According to that Bureau of Labor Statistics report, consumers paid much higher prices for goods in June. Food is more expensive, medical care costs rose, rents are soaring, and wages aren't increasing at that same rate. In fact, wages fell 3.6% from the year before. Liz, is the American consumer going to feel like Biden is gaslighting them when he explains away inflation by saying that the numbers are outdated? I mean, not much has really changed from June to July. And back in December, he was saying that inflation then had hit its peak.
Yeah, I mean, I think American consumers are going to rely mostly on what they see happening in their own checkbooks, right? So they're looking at their bank accounts and they're looking at their spending over time. And they're especially looking at, you know, prices for essentials like gas and groceries. And I think if they still see those prices, you know, really inflated compared to what they're used to, it's not really going to matter what Biden says or, you know, the messaging coming out of the Democrats, period. It's just going to matter, you know, essentially what the Republicans have on offer and how aggravated those voters are versus how aggravated they are at the Republicans for what's on the other side of the ledger.
So why do you think Biden doesn't pull a Bill Clinton and say, I feel your pain on inflation, instead of saying, no, you know, back in December hit its peak and it's not really as bad as people are making it out to be?
Well, I mean, I think there are a lot of strategic reasons that the Democrats might feel hesitant at this moment to say, yeah, you know, bite the bullet. There is an inflation problem, maybe not a crisis, but there are issues. It looks like people have, you know, possibly lost some confidence in the Fed. That's a problem. And, you know, overall, there's a sense of restlessness and unease in the United States at the moment that doesn't just have to do with the economy. It has to do with a lot of broad-based social issues, changes the Supreme Court has made, and this sort of sequence of mass shootings we've had that seem to have people quite unsettled. So when you look at the big picture, I think there are a lot of reasons Democrats feel like with the midterms approaching and then, you know, another possibly contentious general, they're on thin ice and they probably want to project as much as they possibly can a picture of confidence, security, and stability.
Sarah, if inflation is a top priority for Biden, how are you seeing the administration trying to get it under control?
I think one of the hardest parts for this administration is that this is not in their control by and large. This is an inflationary run being caused by a lot of supply chain issues related to COVID. The war in Ukraine certainly isn't helping on the gas prices front. That's not to say that Biden and some of the policies early in his administration, some of the spending, for instance, may have contributed to the current inflation crisis. But I can see being very frustrated if you're sitting in the White House right now and you're being held responsible for a 9.1% year-on-year inflation rate that you feel like isn't in your control. The problem, though, is that it will also speed up this coalition shifting that we're seeing between the Republicans and the Democrats that I'm finding fascinating to watch in real time. It's the first real coalition shift we've seen in our lifetime, which is instead of what Democrats wanted it to be, which is like this coalition of the ascendant on sort of race and ethnicity grounds, instead we're seeing it really around education. So the Democrats are becoming a somewhat whiter party and a more educated, wealthier party, while Republicans are becoming slightly less white, non-college educated voters moving heavily into that column. And I mentioned that in this inflation conversation because when we talk about real wages and discretionary income, if you already had a lot of money, if you were a college graduate with high earning potential, then inflation simply hits you less hard. You own a house, and that is your biggest asset that has also gone up. Whereas non-college graduates with less actual wealth are going to be hit far, far harder by an economic downturn like this. And so I think this will precipitate that move within the Democratic and the Republican parties. Again, something largely out of Biden's control, but something that will absolutely affect his party in 2022 and 24.
I think you're overselling the populism of the Republican Party. I mean, or the whiteness, I would say, of the Democrats. I mean, the black voters are still overwhelmingly, in fact, one of the few groups that are supporting Biden still. And of course, across the American Southwest, or where you have a lot of Latinos, at least especially Mexican Americans, except of course, it seems South Texas, it's still very much a party of Latinos.
But we're talking about trends here, and unquestionably, the Democratic Party is becoming whiter as we're seeing a movement of Hispanic voters looking more like their white counterparts in that non-college educated group. Same with Asian Americans, the largest growing ethnicity in the country. Again, it's not to say that the Republican Party has flipped a light switch and the Democratic Party flipped one too, but overall trends, it's really a change from what we were seeing from the last 20 years and what the Democratic Party was expecting this to be. And so I think when those non-college educated voters are hearing the Biden administration say, those numbers are out of date, don't worry about inflation, we already reached the high point, and instead focusing on some of the progressive priorities that are far more aligned with the white college educated urban voters in the Democratic Party, again, it's hastening that coalition movement.
Speaking of gaslighting, unemployment levels seem to say a different story about the state of the economy. Job growth was stronger than expected, and economists say that's consistent with the country replacing most of the jobs lost during COVID. Liz, how does the Biden-Harris administration sell the gains in the job market to the public as something hopeful, even as prices are still super high?
Yeah, I mean, I think, it's a story about slow recovery from the pandemic. And that's complicated, right? I think they have good reasons to tell voters and to kind of sell, as you say, and really promote the notion that this administration has played a big role in recovery from the pandemic. You know, the problem is there's still quite a bit of frustration and political tension over how the pandemic was handled economically in the first place. So, you know, if we rewind the tape, essentially, the decision that was made about the pandemic at the federal level was that we kind of need to cool off the economy, if not shut it down for a little bit, to keep people separated and give the pandemic sort of time to burn itself out without too much a contagion. And the idea was that the marketplace...
Just like COVID, look at where that went.
Yes, and the idea was that, you know, the marketplace was this sort of locus of all of this contagion. And so we would sort of close it down and that would be that. Didn't exactly work out that way, but it did lead to a huge amount of economic strain for lots and lots of people. And that led to quite a bit of political tension, as we all remember. And so Democrats selling the economic recovery, I think, runs just as much risk of rubbing it in as coming as a relief.
In May, the administration laid out a plan for tackling inflation, and Biden has said that he wants Congress to vote on legislation that would help prices for goods and services. Liz, you're a resident Democratic socialist. What do you want to see Capitol Hill do?
I mean, I have so many wishes. You know, Biden came into office with really big plans. I think, you know, probably the key piece of the Biden administration's agenda that has since sort of slowly fallen off the map is Build Back Better, which is now extant only in a kind of zombified form. It's possible something could still happen with Build Back Better. The key antagonist there is Joe Manchin, Kyrsten Sinema less so. Manchin ultimately couldn't stomach a lot of the, social democratic darlings inside Build Back Better. including the expanded child tax credit, which would have been made permanent. You know, my sense is that Democrats have a lot of disciplining to do with those couple of figures in their party who have made it incredibly difficult for them to execute on their agenda. And if they do really believe that we have a very rough midterm coming up and a very rough general potentially on the horizon, then my advice to Democrats would be discipline those members. I mean, point out to them the country is unhappy with what's been happening with the courts. The party is, you know, potentially on the ropes, but also could stage a comeback if there is enough of a backlash developing based on what Republicans have been doing lately. Democrats would only need to take advantage of it. I would say now is the time to discipline the members who have been standing in the way of Build Back Better, and especially plumb programs like that expanded child tax credit. I think that would be such a political boon, and it would be such a huge benefit for millions and millions of parents and children.
Sarah, does disciplining work on the Democrats' part, or is that just another, shooting themselves in the foot while it's in their mouth?
So I don't think there's an option to discipline them for two reasons. One, in 2002, when we passed into law the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, it basically gutted political parties in the United States because it removed their source of funding. So there is no one to discipline members of a party because there's no actual way to do that. Party leadership has no power. Second,
they're doing that, though, to Liz Cheney in Wyoming, or they're trying to, at least.
Not really. Like, they kicked her out of the conference, and Liz Cheney's raising tons of money and doing her own thing. Now, there's a primary challenger. Plenty of people have that. But in terms of party leadership actually, quote unquote, punishing her, yeah, they removed her from a leadership position. That's about all they can do. So when it comes to Joe Manchin, I think the response is always, okay, if you punish Joe Manchin, whatever that might look like, which again, I'm not sure there's an actual option there, then you will have a Republican in that seat. So Democrats perhaps need to stop thinking of it as a 50-seat majority and instead acknowledge that they have a 48-seat majority, two independents, and then Republicans have 50 seats. Because to say that, you know, Joe Manchin isn't voting with his constituency, Joe Manchin has the largest gap between a presidential vote and a statewide office holder in the country. It's enormous. Nobody else, no Democrat could possibly win that seat in West Virginia. So Democrats should be grateful for the votes they get from him.
Would you prefer then that Congress just bike down to Delaware with Biden for the summer and then leave economic problems to the free market?
Oh, God, what would I prefer? I prefer Congress actually do their jobs. But this is like a whole different conversation. We have a dysfunctional legislative branch at this point where their incentives are structured such that they are better off not doing anything, sitting on cable news. You see new members coming in who don't even hire legislative staff. They simply use their budgets to hire more communication staff to book them on more things because that's how they bring in those small dollar donations, because every time they're on TV or radio, they clip it, put it on social media, bring in $5, $10 at a time. And instead, they've realized that way they can't get flanked from their base or from the middle because they never made any decisions, and let the executive branch deal with it. The problem with that, of course, is that our Constitution doesn't leave legislating to the executive branch. And so then state AGs of whatever the opposing party is during the Trump administration, I'm forgetting, California brought 100 or so lawsuits against the Trump White House, the California AG.
Javier Becerra, yeah.
And now, during the Biden administration, the Texas AG has, I think, already brought 20-something. Other AGs have brought some as well. And then that ends up in the Supreme Court. So we've further politicized the Supreme Court. The administration usually is delayed from actually implementing their policies for about 4 years, which happens to be how long they're in office for. And Congress still does nothing. So that's maybe a too broad an answer for what they do this summer. But I would just like to see any legislation that was like this glimmer of hope with that bipartisan gun bill. But the overall argument, the worst thing that happened to Joe Biden was winning those two seats in Georgia. Joe Biden would be in a much stronger position if Republicans controlled the Senate because he could tell his own party that he doesn't have a choice. He has to do these bipartisan, negotiated, compromising pieces of legislation, and he'd have an actual enemy to run against. Whereas right now, it's hard for Democrats to complain about Joe Manchin, who's a member of their party, as the boogeyman when they control all, you know, both branches of government.
Democrats, of course, are hoping that all these economic troubles go away in time for the midterms. Inflation's done. Gas prices are back to, $3 a gallon, at least here in California. But to the both of you, is this just blind optimism? I mean, how sweating are the Democrats right now coming with November and all this inflation?
I wouldn't be especially optimistic. I mean, I
come on, it's going to end soon, right? It's going to end soon. That's what Biden's saying.
The world.
I mean, yikes.
I think meteor of death 2024.
Yeah. Sometimes I think that would be the tidiest wrap up to all the crises we have. I mean, I think you look at the picture for the Democrats and, you know, there are reasons for cautious optimism, I suppose. And that is, you know, Biden could be right. And we could be seeing a trail off to some of these lagging crises, especially these economic crises that are, you know, mainly a result of disruptions caused by the pandemic. And these are, you know, supply line issues. And there are still supply line issues around the country. They're spotty and they're not as severe as they were in the earlier months of this year and last year. But they're happening and people notice them. Gas prices, like you say, that's declining as an issue in some parts of the country. And then inflation, right? I mean, if it has peaked, that's great. Once again, I mean, I think there are people who will have a hard time reconciling that with what they see going on in their personal finances. On the other side, you have, I think, you know, a particularly strong Republican base that's getting whipped pretty well right now by a couple of candidates who are doing a good job of reaching voters in the grassroots level. And I think you have world events that make it particularly simple at this point for Republicans to reach voters with a clear message. Democrats are on the back foot somewhat because they do control both branches. You know, they control Congress and the executive. They have
ostensibly, yeah.
Ostensibly, right? And, you know, Joe Manchin is a Democrat, and he frankly is the reason that they couldn't get, you know, their big landmark piece of legislation through. And they should have been able to do that in some kind of way, and they couldn't. And the fact that they weren't able to do that was hugely disappointing and demoralizing, and they're going to have to explain that somehow.
Sarah, do the Republicans, are they wishing that inflation continues all the way, at least until November?
You know, I think each party likes it when the other one looks like they're failing, that's for sure. Yeah. But of course, Republicans are going to win the House, and you know, coin flips chance maybe a little better of taking the Senate. And so if you're actually sort of a smart thinker, you sort of want inflation to start cooling now so that by the time you take office, you can say, look, we got into office and the economy got magically better. You know, at this point, I think even if gas prices continue to decline as they have for the last 2 weeks, the economy will recover slowly such that in November, people will still feel that malaise or whatever else you want to call it, that concern about chaos, about recession and everything else. And of course, that's assuming that we're turning a corner right now. There's just no real evidence for that. I understand the gas price point, but there's at least an equal, if not greater chance that we're actually moving towards a recession, not towards an economic recovery. And look, that'll be bad for both parties, frankly. A recession sinks all boats. Because again, Republicans will take over. They may even win the presidency in 2024. A recession isn't going away in 6 months, 2 years, 3 years.
I'll be back with Elizabeth Brunig and Sarah Isger to talk about the revelations in this week's January 6th hearing. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from across the political spectrum. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Gustavo Ariano, columnist at the Los Angeles Times, your guest host coming at you from the center. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic. On the right is Sarah Isger, staff writer at The Dispatch. The January 6th House Committee held their seventh hearing earlier this week. It focused on the links between former President Donald Trump and the far-right extremists that stormed the Capitol, and how Trump and his team mobilized that motley crew to protest and stop the transition of power. Even though, as the committee laid out, Trump was very aware that there was no widespread fraud in the 2020 election. To talk about all the revelations and what's to come, we're joined now by our special guest. Kelly Goff is a columnist and producer of the documentary Reversing Roe. She's also got a new column up in The Hollywood Reporter titled, Having More Women in Power Could Have Raised Urgency of Protecting Roe. Kelly, welcome.
Great to be back.
The latest January 6th hearing specifically looked at a Trump tweet from December 2020. It stated that he couldn't have possibly lost the election and that supporters should protest in D.C. on January 6th with this quote, "Be there, we'll be wild." The committee then played clips from various right-wing figureheads like Alex Jones of InfoWars and the YouTuber Salty Cracker, who took up Trump's call and passed it along to their audience with help from testimony of Stephen Ayers, who rioted at the Capitol. Sadly, he wasn't the witness who wore a t-shirt of punk legends The Descendants to his hearing. The committee laid out the groundwork for how Trump's tweet led to the violence and destruction on January 6th. So, Kelly, how much more damning is this information than what we knew already?
You know, here's why I'm not waffling or tap dancing, but I will say it's a complicated response, as I know a lot of politicians like to say when they don't want to give a straight answer. But the truth is, it is complicated, right? And the reason it's complicated is because I actually think what you're asking are two separate questions. How impactful is it in terms of this actual committee and in terms of the end result of that? And how impactful is it in terms of the big picture of our country? And what I mean by that is, will voters actually care? And that's what I have to tell you has really been concerning me in terms of the overall outcome and reaction to this. Like, here's what I was thinking of. I was thinking of the fact that Barbara Jordan, who is a shero of mine, I'm an African-American woman from Texas. I grew up, you know, knowing about her and what a trailblazer she was for African-American women in politics and in leadership in general. And Watergate made her a star. That speech that she gave made her a star. And everyone knew who she was at the end of that. I think back to the Clinton impeachment, which happened when I was in college. And everywhere you went, that's all anyone was talking about. Compare that to what's happening today. If you stop the average person on the street, what do you think they're talking about? Possibly whether or not there's going to be another round of Amber Heard versus Johnny Depp. They're not talking about this. And that's a concern to me as someone who cares deeply about this country. And so that's why I'm saying it's a complicated answer to your question. Because are we going to find out that Donald Trump tried to subvert our democracy that day? I think we've already found that out. But the question is, if only people like us on this show are talking about it, does that actually have a long-term impact on our country and our democracy? And what scares me is I'm not sure the answer to that is yes.
On the other hand, though, a new Political Morning Consult poll found that 44% of Republicans think that Trump lied about the 2020 election results, and that's up 7% from the previous month. And I'm also thinking of a Yahoo YouGov poll from August 2021 that found 2/3 of Republicans then thought that the 2020 election was stolen. So there's some movement, a little bit, at least.
Yeah. And also, you know, there was a poll, too. I think it was the New York Times Siena one that found that 1 in 5 Republicans, you know, said that he did threaten his democracy with his actions on January 6th. Now, keep in mind, and I know we probably talked about this on this very show a couple years ago, which is there were a lot of Republicans who polled quite critically of him in the Republican primaries, who then we now know ended up voting for him, right? So that's, for me, why, again, I'm not trying to do the traditional politician thing of waffling, but I just think that if the same people who already believe that Donald Trump has been harmful to this country continue to believe he's been harmful to this country at the end of this, I'm not sure how impactful it is. My larger point, I just want to be clear here, is how much media has changed, right? Whether it was during the Watergate hearings, which had, what, 5 channels or something? I wouldn't know, but, and then the impeachment, which we didn't have cable news the way that we do today in the same way. We didn't have Twitter. And today, people's attention is so divided that I don't get the impression that a lot of Americans realize how awful that day was outside of the couple of days of coverage that they watched when it happened. And that's what I'm saying. It's concerning me.
On the other hand, you have been overwhelmed by all this footage, you know, so much footage online, by the way, going on TikTok, going on social media and whatnot. So getting back to the actual hearings themselves, how good of a job did the committee do then at fleshing out these direct links between Trump, his allies, and the two most prominent far-right groups at the insurrection, the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys?
Well, I think it's actually been fairly extraordinary. I think their testimony, I think the spokesperson from the Oath Keepers, I mean, that for me, I know Cassie Hutchinson was a wow moment because she was, you know, from the Trump inner circle. But I actually think the spokesperson for the Oath Keepers was a fairly wow moment, right? Like hearing him actually give voice to the fact that, no, these were racist and dangerous people and kooks. I also thought the moment when Stephen Ayers actually apologized to the Capitol Police, I mean, that wasn't actually a moment of testimony. But I thought that was a really extraordinary moment because at the end of the day, for me, that's what this country, that's where this country is at its best. You know, it's the woman who was spewing hateful things towards a member of the Little Rock Nine apologizing decades later and to get that moment from someone who was there at the Capitol who's now done this 180, I think those are the moments that actually might end up having the bigger impact, Gustavo, than the testimony itself. Because again, whether it's the Capitol hearings or it's policy issues, right? We know that the moments that really that people respond to are the moments of like human to human moments. So I think that Brad Parscale's saying in the email, I wouldn't be able to sleep knowing I killed someone. Like, to me, those are the wow moments out of this hearing. It's someone who worked for Trump saying, this president is responsible for the death of someone, and I can't sleep tonight. How can he? Those, to me, are the moments that actually would have more of an impact than some of the more traditional policy and testimony stuff that I know all of us on this show are parsing over. But I think those are the kinds of moments that are really resonating with other citizens.
So a lot of wow moments, but we're too busy on following Doja Cat to care.
I hate to say it. I think there's some truth in that, though, right? Because, look, this is the example I give, which I know it's a little bit of a stretch, but just hear me out here. It's sort of like how MASH, right, the finale of MASH, the most watched thing in the history of television, right? And people have always speculated, will the Game of Thrones finale top that? Will this top that? Will this
I know where you're going. Go on.
And you know where I'm going with this is there were how many channels when MASH was on? I mean, I think my father watched the finale of MASH, and the joke in my family was my father literally only watched news and sports. If it wasn't politics, news, or sports, he wasn't watching it. He didn't know who any celebrities were. But even he, like, tuned in a little bit to the finale of MASH or to find out who shot JR. Today, someone like my father would never have to watch anything he didn't want to watch because there are 500 channels, there's streamers, there's this, there's that. And the downside, I think, for those of us who are trying to cover things like this, which fundamentally matter to whether or not our country is still standing in another 100 years or, heck, in another 10 years, it's how do we get the public to engage? And, you know, I think anyone who figures that out, if anyone here on the show has figured that out, you've figured out $1 million, something you could sell, so...
And right now, Sarah, the same political poll that I mentioned found that 66% of Republicans don't believe that Trump is responsible for January 6th. So what does this mean for what's next for the GOP once all these January 6th hearings conclude?
I mean, if Kelly's was $1 million question, that's at least the $50,000 question. The Republican Party still struggling day after day to figure out what to do about Donald Trump. Latest round of news this week, of course, is that he is just deciding whether to announce before the midterm elections or after the midterm elections that he is running for president in 2024. I mean, that is such a huge problem for the Republican Party that needs to move on from a four-year Trump presidency, January 6th. I just can't emphasize enough pretty much everything Kelly said. So you can just go back, listen to that all on repeat and put my name on it. But the Brad Parscale part in particular is the moment. And it's what he is texting at the time. As she said, you know, here's a sitting president asking for civil war. This week, I feel guilty for helping him win. If I was Trump and knew my rhetoric killed someone... to which she says it wasn't rhetoric, and he says, yes, it was. But, and here's the important part, a month later, here's what he's tweeting. If they only impeached you twice, you need to run again, because to change the system, you have to kick it in the ass. Yeah. I would love to be the only president to be impeached 3 times, because history remembers those that didn't conform. I'm in, are you? And he is currently working for Donald Trump. And look, let me put a little footnote here, since I worked in the Trump administration. There is a big difference between people who go work trying to make the government work for a president who they have questions about. I was very clear in the run-up to the 2016 election that I didn't vote for him. He asked me to come work for him anyway. Okay. I didn't vote for him in 2020. Very different working in government than trying to get the person elected again who truly does not believe in this American experiment that we're running. Huge problem for Republicans. Clearly, there isn't an answer to that. And yes, it's driven by the Republican base, that's driven by the Republican leadership, that's driven by these, again, a lack of leadership really within the Republican Party and these fringe figures who aren't fringe, because there is no fringe, there is no center, there is no leadership. That's the $50,000 question to Kelly's $1 million question that the Republican Party absolutely hasn't figured out. And it's left a conservative movement behind, because at this point, frankly, neither party is the party of civil liberties anymore. It's the party of power, getting it and maintaining it.
Liz, what do you think in terms of, like, are these impacts, especially as they're starting to ramp up to this grand finale that we're going to talk about in a little bit, are they influencing how people are thinking about what happened on January 6th, especially as it's tied to Trump?
Yeah, absolutely. I think to the degree that I can see people puzzling out what the January 6th hearings mean by watching them online, I think people see them through these, you know, sort of pre-existing frames of reference, for better or worse. And they're reading backwards onto them through the frame of the upcoming election. Ultimately, I think people are, we've had a lot of hearings. I keep thinking about that.
They've been drawn out, too. How long has this been going on for? Like a month, month and a half, it seems, at this point?
It feels like the Hillary Clinton Benghazi hearings ran straight into the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, which ran straight into the Johnny Depp Amber Heard trial, which ran straight into the January 6th hearings. It feels like there's a channel, like, I guess C-SPAN is the channel that you could turn on, and there's always a hearing happening. It's important for a conscious citizen to be engaged and following the activities of the government, especially where it comes to government transparency. It's hard to think of something more important than that. And that's what these hearings actually establish. On the other hand, it's a really high cognitive burden, especially when there are other crises taking place in the country. As I pointed out, these mass shootings, these court decisions, and then inflation and these economic problems, not to mention this sort of lingering pandemic. When people have to deal with all of that, it's a really high cognitive burden to have to also pay attention to these, you know, omnipresent hearings the government is always having to hold itself accountable. It's a lot to ask of an American citizen. It's why being a liberal democracy is a sort of tall order for people, and citizens are expected to take on quite a bit of responsibility and also quite a bit of work. Whether people are up to it and have the capacity for it at this moment, I think is kind of an open question. The people that I have seen, you know, taking it quite seriously and following the hearings closely, yeah, they're reading them through their frames of reference. You know, nevertheless, as you pointed out, I think there are poll changes that reflect that, you know, people are taking into account what they're hearing.
I've been talking with Sarah Isger, Elizabeth Brunig, and Kelly Goff. We'll be back with former President Trump's hopes for a 2024 presidential bid and whether or not they may be squashed. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Thanks for listening to Left, Right, and Center. Is there someone in your life who could benefit from hearing a civilized discussion from all sides? Share the show with them. You can stream all episodes at kcrw.com/LRC, straight from the KCRW app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your guest host, Gustavo Arellano, columnist at the Los Angeles Times. On the right is Sarah Isger, staff writer at the Dispatch. On the left, we're joined by Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at the Atlantic, and our special guest, Kelly Goff, columnist and producer of the documentary Reversing Roe. The January 6th committee hearings continue to try to ensnare former President Donald Trump in criminal legal proceedings, all while, as Sarah mentioned earlier, Trump is already eyeing a return to the White House. There's rumblings that he could announce his presidential bid for 2024 any minute now. But would the GOP back him if he did? Sarah, there doesn't seem to be clear unity among Republicans about whether or not they would back Trump in 2024 if it happened. So do you get the sense that Republicans just don't want Trump to announce right now, or just not at all?
I'm dying at the concept of Republican unity. That's hilarious. It's the best joke we've told so far.
More unified than Democrats sometimes.
Fair enough. I mean, look, the Democratic polling shows that Democrats, by and large, say they don't want Biden to run in 2024. Don't believe it for a second. Yep, they're frustrated with Biden. But Biden is their best option to beat Trump. Why? Because he's proven he already can beat Trump. Biden steps aside, they are left with a primary free-for-all. So that's what the Republicans actually will have.
And Kamala Harris, which is, to your point, yes.
Exactly. I mean, what, Biden's going to endorse her right away? Then they definitely lose in 2024. Not endorse her? Those weekly lunches are going to be awkward. No good options, except Joe Biden on the left. So those polls are about how much Democrats are satisfied with Biden. They are not about him running again. On the right, I went back and looked at polling, you know, going back 20, 30 years when we've had sort of our current primary system. And there has never been a candidate so far ahead of the field as Ron DeSantis, if you take out Donald Trump. He's running 20 plus points ahead of every other Republican. So if you were rational and there were people in charge of the Republican Party, what that would mean is that you have a two-person race between Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis. And there's plenty of evidence that Ron DeSantis could win in that head-to-head race. But we don't live in a rational world. No one's in charge of the Republican Party, and that's absolutely not what's going to happen. You're going to have a whole lot of people throw their hat in the ring because no one learned anything from 2016. I ran Carly Fiorina's campaign, and I will tell you, I look back and absolutely take responsibility for my part in electing Donald Trump, because if there hadn't been 17 candidates, he never would have made it through Iowa and New Hampshire. He built up so much momentum from all the squabbling happening. And so Republicans need to get into a room and all agree that even though they don't like Ron DeSantis as like a person and a buddy and they don't like to get beers with him, that he is the only path to a Republican nominee who is not an actual threat to the continuation of the United States of America. That's not going to happen.
DeSantis is definitely someone that conservative activists know, but he has nowhere near the name recognition of Trump, or he doesn't have that national base that Trump has already established over, gosh, what, the last, an entire career, but politically the last six.
Trump is more famous than any human who has ever lived. There, right? I mean, more famous than Jesus Christ. There's no question that there are more humans on the planet who know Donald Trump's name than ever before. So yeah, Ron DeSantis can't compete on that. But it actually tells you in some of these polls where Ron DeSantis is actually competitive-ish with Donald Trump, that in fact, some of those voters, because they know Donald Trump so well, would be very happy with a conservative firebrand with a record to run on. I mean, right, Harvard, Yale Law, military, has a very good story to tell about what he did in Florida during COVID. They'd like that over Donald Trump. The problem, of course, is that they're not going to get the chance. When Donald Trump announces first, Ron DeSantis still has his election in November. And so he's going to have to wait. And so I think Donald Trump will announce before the midterm elections, in which case it puts DeSantis in a sticky situation.
But here's what I'm keeping an eye on, because she's obviously completely right. And I actually think that the real wild card that hasn't been entirely factored in, although it's increasingly being factored in, is actually not the voters, it's themselves, it's Fox News. Because one of the things I've been following is in terms of DeSantis's name recognition, which you just spoke to, it's nowhere near where Trump's is. And if anyone can help change that in terms of the base, that's going to be Fox or a Newsmax or whoever. I think Newsmax seems to be pretty much on the Trump train. But here's the point I'm getting at, is that every single person on the planet knows who Trump is. That's not always good for him, because a lot of us who know who he is, right, aren't fans. And DeSantis has room to grow. And from what I'm seeing, what DeSantis seems to be really smart on is leaning into all the parental issues, whether it's critical race theory or whether it's some of the LGBTQ issues with parents and schools and this new trans bill he has that I know we don't have enough time for me to go into detail on, but people can go look into that. And I think if that's where his name recognition grows, then his support among the base grows, which speaks to your point of making him the biggest threat. Here's my other big question that I'm keeping an eye on too, though, is if depending on when Trump announces, I think that could also have a huge impact on his level of support. He endorsed, what was it, like 200 candidates this primary season. And it's really been hard to tell in terms of how impactful he's been, right? Because a lot of the people he endorsed didn't have real opponents, or it wasn't really much of a race. And then it's been a mixed bag in like J.D. Vance won in Ohio, but then he had total losses in Georgia and places like that. Here's the point I'm getting at. If a lot of these people that he went all in on to endorse is particularly to punish establishment Republicans who didn't vote to overturn the election or voted in support of the January 6th committee, if a lot of the people he endorsed lose badly in these midterms, I think that actually starts to tarnish him, particularly among some of these voters that we're already seeing in polls are tiring of him, right? Because then it becomes, well, it's clear to than the rest of the field that it's all about him. I think we all on this conversation already knew that. But for voters who believe he's in it for them, if he is endorsing candidates who fall flat on their faces and set the party back further, I think that could potentially be a game changer. The last thing I'll also say is this. So while there's been a lot of conversation about how whether or not Roe being overturned will mobilize Democrats, I think there hasn't been enough of a conversation about Republicans losing one of the main things they had to motivate them to get their base to turn out when a candidate wasn't particularly likable.
Liz, if Trump announces before the midterms, you know, right as the midterm elections happen, what does that then do to the chances of the Democrats? Because, you know, Trump is a grand gargoyle for the Democrats over the past 6 years. Does this then motivate the base to come out, and especially given Roe v. Wade and all these other things?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a good chance of that. So you did see good turnout with the last general election. So this was Trump versus Biden. And I do think that, you know, a good explanation of that is that the Democrats especially did a good job getting out the vote because they had, you know, instilled in their base that they really didn't want another Trump presidency. And it worked. And so I think you would see a similar sort of panicked a get out the vote effort here. And I think that, you know, for those reasons, you would probably see some success with that. On the other hand, there's the possibility of it just creating a bunch of chaos, which I think would also happen. In that case, you know, it's possible that there wouldn't be as much of an organized get out the vote effort as a lot of disorganized sort of protesting and sort of fracturing and perhaps, you know, different strategies emerging from sort of a grassroots perspective versus an institutional party perspective that could be conflicting. So that's also a possibility. It's the left, we fall in love, they fall in line. Falling in love is a lot more chaotic than falling in line. So there's always a sort of outside risk when you're dealing with the left side of American politics. But, you know, I would expect that you'd see, a rise, I think, in turnout.
Political reported this week that the Republican National Committee, the RNC, is in a bind because Trump is a huge moneymaker for the party. But, quote, the party and its leaders have committed to staying neutral in the upcoming presidential election. So say Trump announces, then he would potentially force the party out of neutrality if they continue to town promote him in fundraising campaigns and literature. And if Trump makes them that much money, Sarah, would the RNC prioritize the money over neutrality?
The money is such an interesting part of this whole story. And you have to also get into the history of the money in politics. It's very different than it was 20 years ago, again, when large dollar donors really controlled the market. We now have small dollar donors absolutely controlling political campaigns. And you, therefore, because you have so much more money in politics in these small dollar donations, we've reached a point of not just diminishing returns, but like no particular returns. Campaigns have way more money than they need at that national and even Senate level. House races, the money can still be somewhat predictive on who wins. But in a Senate race, a presidential race, the money has stopped being predictive at all. So the RNC is funding all sorts of consultants and pollsters, huge amounts of staff, people working out in the states. They absolutely will find ways to spend all of this money. And you're exactly right. Donald Trump is personally raising something like 20 cents of every dollar on the Republican side goes directly to Donald Trump. But the rest of that is absolutely tied in with his name, his email list, rental list, all of this ecosystem that exists on both sides. But on the right, Trump is in it. He's in the machinery. So there's all sorts of complications about what happens when he announces the money for the RNC. I think the point about that changing up the midterm elections is really well made. And in fact, we've seen that Donald Trump actually maybe doesn't care whether Republicans do well, maybe affirmatively doesn't want them to do well. There's really no other way to explain what he did in those Georgia Senate races that cost Republicans not just two Senate seats, the control of the Senate, the only check that they would have had on a Democratic president at that point. Donald Trump seemed to relish the Republicans losing those seats, telling voters to stay home. So I absolutely think that Donald Trump could scramble the midterms intentionally for Republicans and absolutely would try to push the RNC to see if he had the power to get them to change their rules to come out and endorse him in advance of the primaries.
and we mentioned Ron DeSantis earlier, and that New York Times Siena College poll showed that DeSantis fared well with people who voted for Biden in 2020, which is interesting when you consider that in 2020, a lot of college-educated Republicans voted for Biden over Trump in key states. So with Biden's poll numbers so abysmal right now, are they the voters, the center, for lack of a better term, are they the voters that each party fights for in 2024? If each of you could respond.
Can I just say really quickly on that, Gustavo, the thing, though, about the Roe decision is it's not just splitting along partisan lines. It's actually splitting really heavy. Those who are college educated, regardless of party, are significantly more likely to say they disagree with the Supreme Court's decision. So I actually think that can end up being more of a wild card in this election. You know, we've talked about soccer moms over the years. We've talked about the independent voters. I actually think that's what's to watch, is where some of those voters go.
Liz, so do you think then these college-educated Republicans, or, you know, people who do want abortion rights, maybe are conservative, but don't want Trump, are they going to be what the Democrats have to fight for in the midterms and in 2024?
I mean, you know, it's possible that that group forms, you know, a considerable constituency. You know, I find it really hard to predict who the swing groups are going to be at this point. Things are, you know, incredibly polarized, and there's quite a bit that's up in the air, especially regarding particular candidates. And I think that will determine quite a bit about who winds up for grabs.
Or Sarah, does each party just go to their wings, you know, go to the left on the Democrats, get all those burners, and then go to the right and get all those Trumpers, and then finally set up the match that everyone wanted back in 2016?
It's fascinating because we'd seen so many base elections in a row in this country that come, you know, 2018, 2020, those weren't base elections. They were incredibly high turnout elections. But instead of swing voters that we're used to talking about, what you saw again was this slow realignment that we're starting to see happen. So I think you will see college-educated, long-term Republican voters start voting more consistently for Democrats. But at the same time, you're going to see those non-college educated, potentially Hispanic and white voters who had traditionally voted Democrat, who we saw move to Donald Trump in 2016, they're going to continue that shift. So it's almost two different sets of swing voters, and it's long-term trends. I absolutely think we're going to see that in 2022.
Kelly Goff, columnist and producer of the documentary Reversing Roe, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to have to leave it right there. We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rant featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Elizabeth Brunig, it's your soapbox.
I like taking my kids to the pool. I think a lot of us do this time of year. There's not much else to do, and I don't really like sweating in my house all day. But one thing I can't stand about going to the pool is goggles. Chlorine's good for your eyes. At least that's what my parents used to tell me, and so I never got used to using goggles. My kids expect to use them because all their friends have them. These are the bane of my existence. They're disgusting. Water, sunscreen, and sand builds up inside the rubber rings around the eyepieces. They get stuck in bags. They get lost. They get hair wrapped around the rubber. They get tangled up in little girls' hair, and they get stuck in pool drains. Kids, chlorine is great for your eyes. The stinging is your eye getting stronger. Don't use goggles.
Sarah Isger, what's your rant?
We now have images from 13 billion years ago, the beginning of the galaxy, the universe. We have these little baby galaxies out there that the James Webb Space Telescope has now brought us. And first of all, I just want to say it's incredible, it's humbling, it's glorious, and it puts all of our problems in perspective. And then at the same time, it doesn't at all, because it doesn't matter what those galaxies were doing 13 billion years ago, because here we are today, and this was an actual headline. Homophobic telescope reveals first high-res images of deep space. So I guess my rant is, headline writers, if you know that our telescope is sentient and capable of homophobia, it must be capable of all sorts of other reasoning, and that should have been the real headline out of the James Webb telescope.
For my rant, yep, I'm going to talk about tacos. No, not the breakfast ones that First Lady Jill Biden awkwardly tried to use as a metaphor for the diversity of Latinos earlier this week. I'm talking about the tacos you buy from street vendors. Chicken, al pastor, suadero, tripitas. More and more taqueros are popping up across the United States, fulfilling the ancient prophecy that a Democratic president would bring taco trucks to every corner. But the rise of taqueros isn't just them trying to meet demand. Many are doing it to survive in this bad economy. Municipalities should help these new entrepreneurs. Instead, the opposite is happening, and supposed liberals are actually leading the charge in a lot of them. In Santa Monica, where KCRW is located, the police have arrested people who are just trying to sell mangoes. In my hometown of Anaheim, the city has teamed up with Orange County officials to target taqueros, when maybe Anaheim should have been paying attention to the, quote, cabal that an FBI affidavit this summer claims rules City Hall. Everyone, repeat after me. Carne asada is not a crime. Leave the taqueros alone. Y deme 12 adobada para llevar. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks to Sarah Isger and Elizabeth Brunig. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Jenna Cagle. The show is recorded and mixed by Matt Schwartz. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Gustavo Ariano. Thanks for joining us. Tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center. Gracias.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.